Twin Cities News Talk. Justice Andrew, along with Sam, screening your phone calls at 651-989-5855. I know we've got guests joining us, but I'm really looking forward to talking about, in the 8 o'clock hour, the female-friendly Doritos.
Mm.
I'm looking forward to the female-friendly Dorito discussion. It's so stupid.
Are they lavender-flavored?
They don't crunch as much? Is this the female-friendly Doritos?
It's very odd.
Sam, do you have an issue when you bite into something and it crunches and you go, oh, why is this so loud? Why is it so manly? why is this made for a man? Why is this Cheez-It so crunchy?
Did you say female-friendly what?
Doritos.
I haven't heard anything.
All right, okay,
that.
We'll pump the brakes on
it. It is caucus day. Tonight's caucuses are taking place across the state tonight, so we're having a couple of the gubernatorial candidates in, Keith Downey at 7:35, Jeff Johnson at 8 o'clock this morning.
Quick update on the FISA memo. David Nunes said yesterday the FBI had disclosed political backing for a Trump-Russia dossier in October 26, but the controversial GOP memo released last week did not mention it. Republican leaders are acknowledging the FBI disclosed the political origins of a private dossier to the Bureau, citing in the application to surveil former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page, undermining, according to Politico, the controversial memo released Friday and fueling the Democratic demands to declassify more information about the Bureau's actions.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, please, do. Yeah. By all means.
Put the warrant out there. I mean, you're surveilling an American citizen.
Right.
You know, that's the thing. This is not a question of surveilling potential terrorists or ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab or any known terrorist group or anything like that. You're surveilling an American citizen. And so I have no problem with as much transparency as you can muster. You know, put it all out there. We should have a right to know when we're being surveilled and under what grounds we're being surveilled.
Nunes was asked on Fox and Friends about reports over the weekend that the FBI application did refer to a political entity connected to the dossier. It's unclear precisely what language the application might have used. Nunes concluded the footnote to that effect was included in the application while faulting the Bureau for failing to provide more specifics. A footnote saying something may be political is a far cry from letting the American people know the Democrats and the Hillary campaign paid for dirt that the FBI then used to get a warrant on an American citizen to spy on another campaign. Nunes is absolutely right. Absolutely right. And look, it doesn't change anything. If the FBI knew it was funded by the DNC and the Clinton campaign, okay, then it's on the FBI for going and actually continuing to push this information, which was clearly bias, you know, gossip labeled as intel, to go and get this FISA warrant. I know what the Democrats are saying here. They're saying, see, they omitted something from this. Well, yeah, there was a lot of things omitted from this. They basically gave you a shorter version of everything that they saw in a four-page memo. Now, if the Democratic memo happens to go and show that what they put out, that Nunes and the Republicans put out in the memo, was wrong, okay, then we'll deal with that when the time comes. But I'm with you. I get the feeling it's going to be 11 pages of, and that's the first three pages.
So there's going to be a rebuttal memo, and then there's probably going to be another rebuttal memo. And what frustrates me is that at the end of the day, all of this is just going to give those people who are so inclined every justification and excuse they need to just stay in their partisan camp.
Yeah.
And just look at this as nothing more than a partisan issue. There are serious constitutional concerns with the process of the FISA court, with the way that it operates under complete secrecy, and the abuse that is being done by some bad actors within the FBI or within the Justice Department. That doesn't mean that you're casting aspersions on the entire organization or the entire establishment of the FBI or the Justice Department. But to think that there aren't bad actors in those organizations that are willing to use the tools made available to them for partisan purposes to advance their personal agendas or their political agendas or just their careers is incredibly naive.
You know, and it needs to be said too that sometimes I think we get a we get a misguided view of how this stuff is shaking out. Look, if the Democrats want to keep if the Democrats in Congress want to keep wasting their time on this, fine, let them. Right, the economy is going to continue on. Congress is still going to continue to go and try to get the work done that they need to get done. We've got the potential of another budget showdown coming up. If they want to continue to argue over this, it's fine. And you can say the same thing about the GOP, but it's a select number of individuals that are going and putting this memo out. And sometimes I think we get this view that everything's coming to a grinding halt. It's not. This is why I don't mind when Trump tweets, because I feel like he just gets it out of his system. You know, he tweets it out, makes his comment, and we move on. But if the Democrats want to focus on this and not what Congress is trying to go and get done, let them. Because to me, the more that they push back, the more it undermines this narrative of Trump and Russia collusion, which is really just their excuse for their inability to get over that Hillary lost. I mean, say Hillary lost.
Yep.
She lost.
Yep.
She lost. What happened? Go read the book.
She's still out there blaming, you know, sexism and misogyny.
Of course she is.
Yeah. Not I was a horrible candidate and took the win for granted, so I didn't go campaign in some key battleground states. That had nothing to do with it. Just sexism and misogyny.
It must be just...
And Russians.
It must be hard to be that delusional. So glad she's not president.
I know.
Just, you know, just a little bit of self-awareness to realize what, you know.
The best part of waking up is knowing Hillary lost to Trump.
You know, that feels about as good as a really good fresh cup of coffee, too. It really does.
Wakes you up a little bit.
It does. Star Tribune. A severe measles outbreak sickened dozens of Minnesotans last year, threw a harsh light on activists and vaccination concerns, but now they're back. Believing they have gained the political clout to push through legislation that would alert parents to the rare but documented risks of vaccines. So you get to the heart of the issue here, right? So there was a forum that took place, leaders of the Vaccine Safety Council of Minnesota, hoping to persuade lawmakers to support an informed consent bill, which would require doctors to discuss the risks with parents before vaccinating babies. Okay, so Jennifer Larson, the leader of the nonprofit council and the organization called Health Choice, organized a forum saying there's been a shift in the country. I think it's tough for anyone to say more information is not better. Okay, Larson said her group is not anti-vaccine. They just believe that consumers need more upfront information about the risks. State health officials, though, they worry that opponents want to promote unproven claims that could unnecessarily scare people away from vaccinations.
And I share those concerns.
Yeah, because you don't want to go to the doctor, right? I don't want to go to the doctor with my kid, and before my kid gets a vaccination, have my doctor go, now look, before I administer this vaccination, I want you to be aware that Jenny McCarthy has said that by getting this vaccination, there's potential that your son could grow a thumb from his forehead and then develop telekinesis powers. So I just want you to know that Jenny McCarthy is very, very concerned over your son getting this vaccine.
Yeah.
That's the concern that I have.
Because there is a lot of misinformation out there, and there is a lot of fear-mongering out there when it comes to vaccines. And you take these incredibly low-risk and isolated and rare situations, and you tell parents about them. I mean, there is not a more frightened creature on the planet than a new parent, you know, and they want to do everything right, and they do not want to put their kid at any risk whatsoever. And if there is the slightest 0.001% chance that something bad might happen, they're going to second guess and they're going to reconsider their options. Vaccines, by and large, are incredibly safe. This is a tough issue for me because I am in agreement with the statement that more information is better.
Sure.
You know, and I'm fine with doctors, you know, laying out as much information as possible and giving parents the options. And I'm not in favor of it, of anything coercive. I'm not in favor of forcing, you know, making it punishable by law if you choose not to vaccinate your kids. Not in favor of that. But at the same time, you know, public schools, I think, have every right to say if your kid isn't vaccinated, then you need to go find some other place to have your child educated.
Yeah, it has to be relevant and proven data as best it can be. Chris Erisman directs the vaccination programs for the state health department. Said that talking about the measles outbreak, the 79 cases, 71 of the 79 cases last year were unvaccinated individuals. It was very much an outbreak driven by a lack of vaccination.
Yeah, of course.
Survey data from the U.S. From the CDC shows a small decline in certain immunizations. But anxiety about the safety of vaccines has created an active coalition that includes some Minnesota refugee families, proponents of natural medicine, and parents who believe disabilities in their children can be traced back to the shots that they receive. So Larson here is the owner of an IT business and an autism treatment center, recently named new finance chair of the Republican Party here in Minnesota. She stressed in an interview that the new role is separate from her advocacy on vaccines. Says she took on the issues of vaccine administration and informed consent after her son, now 17, developed autism following his infant vaccinations. My son had a very clear reaction, she said. The autism theory has bedeviled public health advocates because no broadly accepted study has proved a link between the vaccines and the developmental disorder. Now, Larson went on to say that she believes health officials have exaggerated the safety of vaccines. She noted the federal government's National Vaccine Inquiry Compensation Program has paid $3.8 billion since 1988 to people who claim the vaccine-related illnesses or reactions. Parents want to be told everything before they inject something into their child, she said. And again, it comes back to who is going to be the one to provide that information and what is that information going to be based on. And that's where, in my opinion, the biggest concern is, because you're right. It would not take much. Trust me, I know, because I have a wife who is obviously very concerned for the safety of our children. And just like you said, any parent would be. It doesn't take much for a parent to stop short seeing a piece of data and go, well, you know, the odds of him having to deal with something, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'll maybe I'll cross my fingers and hope nothing happens.
And here's the part of the bill that I have a problem with. The last paragraph of the story, the Minnesota Medical Association opposes the bill because it only requires vaccine risk information that would discourage parents, does not require information about the risks of children being unvaccinated.
Right.
That's a little one-sided, because if you're going to compel doctors to list out all these dangers, whether, you know, no matter how low the risk of those dangers are, then the doctor should be able and should also be giving the other side of the dangers of not vaccinating your child, and not just the dangers to your child, but the dangers your child then presents to other children if they are unvaccinated. Because vaccinated children, when exposed to unvaccinated children who are carrying something, can still, you know, vaccines aren't 100%.
Right.
It's the herd mentality. You know, the more children that are vaccinated, the lower the risk for everybody becomes.
We should just have it where you go to the doctor, here's the vaccine, here's what it's supposed to do, right? And if you need further information, go to these different organizations. Right. If you're a part of this organization that wants more information put out there, then find a way to go and put the information out there. There's no need, at least in my opinion, to go through the government and to put in requirements for the doctor to add additional information that may or may not be correct. Just have the doctor, and they already do that. In the story, it talks about, Erisman said, federal law already requires doctors to give vaccine information statements to parents, and the state checks to make sure the pediatricians are doing so. The statements refer to vaccine risks and the compensation fund, but also the benefits of vaccine and the threats caused by infections that they target. Okay, so if you want other information out there, then use your time and effort to go and provide that information for free to the public in a way that parents will go and get it. That's a better use of your efforts.
And a lot of them are. A lot of them are doing that. But the bad thing is a lot of them are spreading misinformation.
Yeah. Well.
Or at least unfounded information.
Well, I certainly don't want that misinformation, you know, having to be required to be pushed out by the government when the kids go and get their vaccinations.
Yeah, the answer to this is not more laws and more government.
Isn't it usually, though?
Right.
That's usually the answer, isn't it?
No, yeah, that'll fix everything.
651-989-5855. Speaking of more laws and more government, coming up in just a moment, Star Tribune, St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter walks into the $15 minimum wage battle. And the St. Paul leaders and businesses say the minimum wage battle won't be a repeat of Minneapolis. In the story that will...
Yeah, they're not going to bother listening to the opposition this time.
That's the problem.
Right.
You hit the end credits. You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, we're just going to ignore you from the get-go. We're not going to pretend to hear your concerns this time. 651-989-5855. Anthony in St. Paul, go ahead. Anthony.
So right off the bat, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So right off the bat, I'm not going to act like I'm a scientist or anything. There's a lot of conflicting information about vaccines, and it takes I'm a fairly new parent. It makes it very difficult to actually make a decision.
Sorry, your phone's cutting out there, Anthony. Try back in a little bit. We'll see if you can get in a better area and give us a call back.
Yeah, we will. We'll continue to take your calls on this. We'll dive into this St. Paul mayor and this $15 minimum wage battle. I've got a few words to the business community in St. Paul who seem unwilling to go and step up on this. We're going to say, well, we're just going to wait back and hear what the Citizens League says. No, you need to be proactive on this, and they're not.
Justice.
Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 at 103.5 FM. Justice Andrew, along with Sam.
651-989-5855 is the phone number. We're going to talk to Keith Downey here. Coming up in the next segment, followed by gubernatorial candidate Jeff Johnson as well, and Pete Hegseth. We were discussing the story in the last segment regarding a push to require doctors to lay out the risks of vaccines to parents. Darren in Savage has a comment. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on. Hey, I'm a medical assistant, and I give people shots all the time. And most of the time when you give the patients the VIS, which is the required form we have to give them by the CDC, a lot of times they throw them away or they leave them in the office anyway. Mm-hmm. And the ones that do keep them, I don't even think they read them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And passing this law is just going to sort of continue that behavior, I think. You know, I think a lot of the reaction of a lot of doctors, I believe, this law gets passed, would be to just create another form that you hand rather than standing there and verbally listing all of these risks and say, here's some information on the vaccines that your child is scheduled to receive today. Look it over if you want. And probably about 3% of parents will actually look at it.
But in my opinion, however, you have a greater chance to do harm if you get a bill like this passed, depending on what that data is, because now if you're putting out a bunch of information that's going to be scaring a bunch of people, then there are parents that perhaps maybe would have gotten a vaccine for their kid that may decide they're not based off of data that might be thin.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts other kids, you know, like mine at risk if they go to school with that kid who didn't get vaccinated.
Yeah. You said it perfect during the break.
Yeah,
if worry about your own kid.
Yeah,
don't worry about other people's kids.
Yeah, if it's not your kid, then you know what? Then don't sweat it.
Don't try to convince other parents to vaccinate or not vaccinate, depending on your personal beliefs.
Yeah,
you just worry about your kid.
People should do that more often.
Yeah,
unfortunately doesn't happen. A month into his term, St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter faces pushback on one of his biggest campaign pledges, raising the city's hourly minimum wage to $15 an hour. Business leaders, bruised after Minneapolis approved the wage hike last year, don't want a repeat in St. Paul. Well, they're going to get one.
Mm-hmm.
Activists on different sides of the debate over the tip credit are gearing up for another fight. And though city council leaders agree the minimum wage needs to be higher, they don't agree on the number. Council President Amy Brenmoen said the mayor is using 15 as his goal. But we've continued to say the question is how much and over how much time and for whom? They say they intend to pass a wage ordinance this year. Brenmoen and Council Vice President Rebecca Knocker said that they want more data and discussion. Let me stop right there. Look, that's great. I'm fine for the data and discussion only if that data and discussion includes not implementing a $15 minimum wage.
Right. Put that on the table as an option.
Right.
Yeah.
Not having one.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to do that,
no,
though.
No, they're not. They're starting the discussion from the point of, we are going to increase the minimum wage in St. Paul. The question is just by how much, and are we going to do it over time, Are we going to include a tip credit? Those are really the only questions they appear to be considering.
They're waiting for a report from the Nonpartisan Citizens League, which the council commissioned last year to study the minimum wage question. The preliminary report is expected this month. You get further into the article. There's one point. Let me jump here towards the end. The council members, okay, they're talking about the ability, the opportunity is to do better than Minneapolis did in St. Paul. Bren Moen and Knocker all said that they intend to put forward a policy tailored to their city. That statement stuck out to me. I don't like it. This idea that we're going to force the businesses to pay a particular wage and make it tailored to our city. It underscores the fact that you have the government stepping in once again, and the points that we've said over and over again, stepping in and forcing a business to go and pay a certain salary. But this tailored to their city adds another dimension in my book, where again they're thinking of this not in the business's best interest, but in their own minds of how they feel people will go and spend this extra money in their city. I mean, there's a lot of profiling that needs to be done if you're going to be doing something tailored to your particular, to your city. And it speaks to their mentality on these issues. In an interview, Carter reiterated his commitment to signing a $15 minimum wage into law before the end of the year and said he's already talking to business owners, workers, unions, and advocates. You think he's listening to the business owners who don't want it?
I don't know. I don't know Melvin Carter that well, but if Minneapolis is any indication and the way it went down there, the answer is probably no, because that was what we heard from business owners repeatedly. And we still hear it from business owners in the downtown Minneapolis area, that their voice is not heard.
St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce President and CEO B. Kyle said he's reserving judgment until people have a chance to react to the Citizens League report. Why? Why?
We know. I mean, we know what minimum wage ordinances do. We have data from other cities. We've seen it happen time and time again. This is the most predictable thing out there right now.
Right.
We've seen it happen. Why are you reserving judgment? And it's not even reserving judgment until he sees the Citizens League report, probably because he already knows what it's going to say.
Right.
But he's reserving judgment until people have a chance to react. So he's going to kind of stick his finger in the wind and see how people react before he steps out there. That's been the problem with the business community, the leadership in the business community in this area for a long time.
And unfortunately, you get there's one business owner in here that talks about supporting this minimum wage, but wants business owners to have the opportunity to talk with officials and inform the ordinance that eventually goes forward. Look, and that's part of the issue here is you get like one business owner who has crafted their particular, you know, business model based off the idea of paying their employees $15 minimum wage. So they're all hunky-dory with it. But unfortunately, that particular business owner ends up being used to push the argument when it's not the right thing to do. Who are you to go and speak for other business owners?
Sean O'Byrne, who has owned Great Waters Brewing Company since it opened in 1997, in the story says he's worried about keeping his business afloat if the $15 an hour minimum wage passes without a tip credit, and he isn't convinced conversations with policymakers will make a difference.
Yeah.
And I think that statement right there represents so many in the business community in the Twin Cities area. He says, you can talk all you want, but they have to listen. And right now, politicians aren't in a mood to listen. They think they know what's right for business. And they're going to impose it upon you, whether you like it or not.
Other business owners declined to comment, including some who said they were worried about the backlash. And that, and this goes back to the problem that you have, because if you are going to be able to push back on this at all, you're going to have to be organized. And we saw a bit of that happen in Minneapolis, but unfortunately it didn't work. The activists have a lot of time on their hands, and this is what they're devoted to. The business owners don't. I get that. I don't run a business. I've thought about running a business in the past. I've already seen just how difficult that can be. I can only imagine how hard it must be to have the government come in and try to go and mandate how much you're going to go and pay your employees, and also how hard it must be to go and be part of a coalition that pushes back against this because you got a business to run. Mm-hmm. But therein lies the problem. If the business community in those areas that's chosen to work, in this case in St. Paul, if they don't together stand up and try to be as loud a voice as they can to offer up the arguments against these activists that have no stake in this at all, mm-hmm. then it is going to pass, and they're going to only be able to partly blame themselves.
Dan in Minneapolis. Good morning, Dan.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
I just want to comment on the minimum wage, and I'm sure you guys know all these studies, but I saw a Harvard study or whatever that studied the effects that it had recently on Seattle when they raised the minimum wage. What they were saying is, you know, the business owners have to respond by either cutting, you know, the hours for people so they don't have to pay benefits, or they have to, cut the hours just and make others work harder. And then the effect has been that the average person wound up with probably like $120 less in their paycheck and often lost benefits. And so there's all these other repercussions that these people, they don't even want to think about. And yet businesses have to keep their doors open. They're not just these people with these unlimited coffers that, you know, that are just magical, that just fill every time somebody wants something. And people just don't seem to realize that. It's crazy.
And Dan, we're so glad that you called, because, and thank you for the phone call. And that's exactly the reason why. That's exactly the reason why they make comments like, we're going to tailor it for our city. That's exactly the reason why they say that, because that's all the excuse they need to have somebody going, look what happened in Seattle, and go, oh, don't worry about it. We're going to tailor ours to St. Paul. It'll be a lot better.
Yeah, it's not going to have the same effect at all.
651-989-5855. Joining us in a studio, we're going to be speaking with Keith Downey. Looking forward to it.
Justice in...
Justice and Drew, Sam is actually, right as we speak, screening your phone calls at 651-989-5855. Precinct to caucuses. Start the sorting of candidates to become Minnesota governor. He's in studio now. We're going to be talking with Keith Downey here in just a moment.
We were discussing the St. Paul efforts to increase the minimum wage. We want to take Don from Burnsville. Good morning, Don.
Good morning. Say, I'm looking at my computer right now, and I can't find a single write-up that says anything bad about the raising minimum wage.
Well, you're not looking very hard.
Well, have you checked? Okay. Are you sure you're online?
Well, that's why I called you. Yeah, because okay. I'd like you to give me a couple of sites.
All right, I'm gonna give you something to search. All right, you ready? Okay. All right, go to the Google. Yeah. Consult the mighty Google.
Just let me write this.
Well, you have to use the AOL search engine.
Yeah,
he's still using the disk.
What should I search for?
Go to Ask Jeeves.
GeoCities. Sorry.
The Washington Post did a story. It's a few years old now, but the Washington Post, off the top of my head, did a story examining the impact of the minimum wage in Seattle after a few years, and what it did specifically to low-wage jobs, restaurant jobs, fast food jobs, service industry jobs there. So if you just Google Washington Post Seattle minimum wage study, if you search that, you will find a story very critical of the impacts of the minimum wage. It's not hard.
Yeah, along with hold on real quick. Along after you're done with the Google, use the web crawler search engine, and then if you go to reason.com, go to reason.com, go to their search engine and search Seattle minimum wage, and you know, enjoy the rest of your day being wrong.
Seattle, you can search Seattle, you can search Los Angeles, you can search a number of them.
Yeah.
Drew in Seattle, real quick, go ahead.
Hey guys, this is Andrew from Seattle. I called in a couple weeks ago about the Seattle soda tax too. You know, I feel like I'm going to have to be calling in here more often as Minneapolis starts to become more like Seattle with all their craziness.
Right.
So here's the deal. The University of Washington, which is a liberal university, which is headquartered right in the heart of the Seattle, put a study out that essentially trashed the $15 an hour minimum wage act, essentially saying that people actually made less money because of this, because businesses had to adjust. Now, the city council counteracted that and hired Berkeley to do a study on their end trying to contradict that. But you have to see here is that, you have to realize that Seattle, given its economic development, it's a booming city, you know, it didn't work there in Seattle,
right,
which has a stronger economy than, I'm sorry, Minneapolis does. What makes you think it's going to work in Minneapolis? And just to give you one more thing. Tacoma, which is about 40 minutes down south from Seattle, after it got passed there, tried to pass it there. But Tacoma has a much weaker economy. After they did their analysis, that they said, we're not going to touch this because it's going to destroy our local businesses. And we don't have the kind of economic structure and support to be able to support this type of mandate. That's all I wanted to just leave it.
Yeah,
right
well,
there.
I mean, again, and look, and it kind of goes back to what we talked about with St. Paul when they say we're going to tailor it to our city. You know, I do want to take this and roll this over to our guest joining us in studio. Keith Downey is with us. Just real quick on this, and then we can talk about caucus night. In the story, it talks about the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce opposing the wage hike. Will support preemption efforts at the legislature. That's been a bit controversial, you know, because it depends on who's going to be in power. Who do you want to preempt? You know, local laws. Where do you kind of land on that? And you can be specific to the minimum wage here.
Well, I don't support state intrusion into local issues in general, and I wouldn't hear either. The challenge or the problem is that you're effectively saying it is an appropriate move for state government to determine the minimum wage and all these work rules, right? So I'm not sure you want to go there either, because right. Then all the lobbying occurs at the state, and now you got a one-size-fits-all across the entire state. So I wouldn't support that. I think Minneapolis and St. Paul have got to come to grips with their own situation, and the business community needs to probably work harder getting the right people elected in those communities. And sometimes you just have to let things play out and see what the impact is, and then adjust from there and realize the mistake as compared to always asking the next layer of government to cover for your problems.
Would you, not that it would ever reach your desk, but I mean, if it hypothetically, could you support I hate the word ban, but I'm failing to find a better word, a ban on setting wages across the state?
I'm not sure what the legality of that would be either, right, in terms of local control. You got charter counties and other things constitutionally you'd have to consider. So I'd have to just say I don't know for sure. Yeah. I'd want to look at it. But in general, local control is the guideline for me.
Can we have a law that just says that business owner can set their own wages?
Correct.
Yeah, very simple.
Go that route.
That I would probably cite.
A business owner will be in charge of setting their own wages. That's it. Yeah.
Nobody else.
And credits.
Yeah.
That's it.
Right.
Keith Downey, candidate for governor. Good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
It is Caucus Tuesday.
Yes, it is.
Caucus day, caucus night here in Minnesota. For those that aren't familiar with the process or perhaps haven't participated in caucuses before, explain why caucus night is such a big deal in the governor's race.
Well, quick background. Minnesota is one of just a handful of states that remain a caucus state. And so here in Minnesota, our governor and, well, the statewide elections and also the presidential year elections all start on caucus night. 4,000 precincts meet in 300 physical locations across the state the first Tuesday.
That's a lot.
In February. The Democrats do it. The Republicans do it. The Independence Party, to the extent that they can pull it off, they do it. And that's the process whereby the delegates, who ultimately will endorse our state statewide candidates, are selected. And there's a straw poll, too. By law, it's required for president on the presidential years and then for governor on the off years. So there will be a straw vote tonight as well.
What is the, just pure curiosity on my end, but what's the vibe going in tonight? I mean, what's the general general mood? Is this something that people are like really kind of looking forward to, or is it more procedural, like this is how things start and we've got to go through the motions here?
Well, it's a little bit of both, and I think that's what's so important in this election year. We had what you could argue was a wave election in 2016 in terms of a new group of people coming into the process, being very excited about finally having somebody who was going to take on the establishment form, who wasn't afraid to just tell it like it is, and those people are sitting out there evaluating whether they're going to participate again. So we've been inviting those folks to be part of it, and I think it's really, really important. On the Republican side, we have a chance this year. This is a time where we can grow our coalition. We can build the Republican base in this election, and it starts on caucus night. So I think it's really important for us, and we're working very hard as a campaign. I personally making phone calls to folks and telling them we need them to participate. If you're you've ever been sick and tired of what's happening in Washington, D.C. or St. Paul, if you've ever complained about the candidates that are on the ballot, this is your chance to be part of the process. You show up in a neighborhood meeting room, raise your hand, become a delegate, vote in the straw poll, and you have a chance to have an influence.
What is the bearing of the straw poll going forward? Obviously, you know, the first step, not the first step, but the big next step is gaining the endorsement of the Republican Party going forward. And then potentially there might be a primary after that that you would have to win. But what role does the straw poll play in gaining that momentum towards the endorsement?
Well, historically, the straw poll has not been very predictive. In fact,
so you don't want to win.
Well, I've always thought that at the beginning of a campaign, it's kind of like the Kentucky Derby. You don't want to be that horse that's way out in front on the first turn and then lose your gas. So I think you want to build and show momentum and show that you're credible. You know, we literally on my campaign have ramped up and delivered physical materials and signs and things to those 300 locations. I think it's an important sign of strength what you do. The results, I think, are not necessarily predictive. Jeff Johnson finished third with 15% in the straw poll 4 years ago and went on to win the endorsement. So there's maybe more of a history of it not being predictive, but it's still an important event. It's a big night. People need to see that you're a credible campaign, that you got a really positive, strong message that people are responding to.
Now, before we get back to some of the expectations tonight, let's talk a bit about last time we had a discussion on the air, and your name was brought up. It was in regards to a Facebook controversy and a website that was created and a staff member or former staff member. Can you provide sort of some clarity on that? I mean, you weren't involved in our conversation, but we talked about it quite a bit based off the news story, and kind of like to hear your side of what had happened.
Sure. It was a staffer who came on board and let me know a couple days later that they had been the administrator on a Facebook page that was opposing Jeff Johnson. And so we immediately made sure that that person was not the administrator and that the site was taken down, which it was. But as per usual in politics, it was conflated into a huge set of things. Many accusations against me and my campaign and this person, all of which were false. Three very specific, serious charges, including one where it's a crime to go out and steal a URL. Well, this wasn't even a website. It was a Facebook page. Right. And so it got ridiculous. And I pursued as much as I could the facts. We were transparent and told the truth about everything the whole way. And I even approached the Johnson campaign and asked for facts or evidence that would somehow support these wild charges out there. None coming forward. We just moved on and said, you know what? We've done our due diligence. We've been totally straight up and honest on this thing, and we're moving forward. And I think all the campaigns have now.
Did the person responsible for it, did you know before it sort of became public that this person on your staff had created this page but maybe was no longer involved with it or anything?
Yeah, correct. That was the exact timing. And all of this occurred way before that person came on my campaign, and our campaign is doing nothing of the sort. I've you know, come out and very publicly denounced trolling and other parody type sites. I mean, our campaign is not going there. The reality is that's a huge part of social media. Anybody who thinks it isn't is kidding themselves. And if they think it wasn't a huge factor in the 2016 election, it was. And I got to tell you, if you're not prepared to do battle on that front, you're not prepared to win in 2018. So, you know, we need to have a really strong social media capability. I've come out strong. The person, you know, admits it was a mistake and we're moving forward. But we're going to be really strong on social media. I think we are. And we're going to compete hard on it all the way through to November.
The only other question that I had on this, and don't want to belabor, the only question I had is with the controversy, you know, getting to where it got, why not just let that particular staffer go to sort of avoid any, you know, and any sort of appearance that perhaps it was something that it wasn't? That's the one question that I had.
Because that's what politicians do. And that's what the political hacks want in this whole thing, right? I mean, I'm not going to take that. I treated this like a business person would, right? You get the facts and you treat people fairly. No way am I going to do that just because a bunch of political hacks light up the social media. No way. And I think that's what people are looking for. Somebody who's got the strength of their convictions, who's going to do the right thing, whether somebody's watching or whether thousands of people are making stuff up on social media. We're going to do the right thing on my campaign.
We talk a little bit about the sort of elephant hanging out just outside the room. The rumors about Tim Pawlenty possibly jumping into this race at some point. It appears just from an outsider look, speculation that you got the Republican candidates right now, yourself, Johnson, and others that are all vying for the endorsement. And I believe every one of you have said that you will abide by the endorsement.
Right.
However, if Tim Pawlenty jumps in, say after the endorsement, and decides that is going to run as a primary, does that change the calculation of the abiding by the endorsement for yourself or for in other campaigns? If you would speculate.
Boy, it's hard to speculate the exact timing and the nature of that. My commitment is to abide by the endorsement. I think that's the winning strategy. And somebody jumps in afterwards, I don't think they really have a good chance, regardless of their money or their name ID. Let me just go back to what I said before about this being a follow-on election to a year when a bunch of people, the forgotten men and women, people who are looking at the establishment, they're looking at the political status quo and the political elites, and they're saying, we're done. We're sick and tired of this. We want somebody who's going to go out there and fight for us. And so my campaign, and this is consistent with who I've been in business and in the legislature and at the state party, we've been really bold. We've told it exactly like it is, exactly what we're going to do. I've got really in-depth policy proposals out there. And my conviction is that if you go out and talk to the people of Minnesota, across the state, all walks of life, even when you're vying for the endorsement, you get out and you start launching a general election campaign and you're bold and you tell them exactly what you think and they have confidence that you're going to do it. That's what the electorate is looking for. And I'll tell you what, a bunch of political games and posturing and, you know, dramatic pauses and, you know, timing decisions and people making decisions purely on politics, that's what people are sick and tired of. So we're running the same race. We're going to be bold. We're going to be out across the state of Minnesota telling people, if you want a candidate who's going to go down and take on those entrenched special interests in St. Paul, you want a candidate who's going to tell you what they mean and mean what they say and then go do it, then I'm your guy. And so that's the message. We're sticking with that. I think it's the right thing. It's who I am. It's what I want to do as governor. So that's what we're going to do regardless of who does what and what their timing is.
What's your schedule like heading into tonight? You're going to be up all night? How long are these things going to go for?
it's not quite like general election night. No, we're laying out my schedule now, and I got a couple decisions to make about where to go. But we'll be extremely busy today, calling and getting our folks out and making sure everything's set up logistically across the state. And hopefully we'll have a good night and show some momentum.
How many caucus sites do you anticipate you'll be visiting over the course of the evening?
Well, it's pretty tough because caucuses start at 7, sometimes depending on the size of the precincts and things, they can be over by 8 o'clock.
Wow.
So you have a chance to maybe get in a half dozen, max a dozen precinct rooms. So you got to pick a spot where you can get around a little bit. And, we'll figure out exactly which building and what rooms we're going to try and get in here this afternoon as we see how it plays out.
And the key is turnout, right? I mean, you want as many Keith Downey supporters as possible showing up to caucus in all the various locations. What's your final message for those people that might be considering of attending a caucus tonight?
Yeah, you know, if you want somebody who's going to bring an outside perspective, a more business perspective, somebody who isn't afraid to take on those special interests, the entrenched interests down in St. Paul, who's going to fight for the people of Minnesota, that's me. The theme of our campaign is that we are going to make Minnesota work for everyone, and there are far too many places around this state where it's not. We go out as Republicans, I go out as a Republican candidate, and fight for those people, and show them that our ideas are going to work for them, they're better for them and their families in this state. We can have a great year this year, but we got to pay attention to that essential characteristic of the electorate, that they are sick and tired of what's going on. They still are, and they're looking for candidates who are going to be genuine and fight hard for them. And if that's who people want, I'd love to be their candidate. I'd love to be their governor.
When that previous caller, Don from Burnsville, is done searching for minimum wage stories, where can he go find out more about your campaign?
DowneyForGovernor.com, and we got a caucus page there, too. You can link over to the Secretary of State site and figure out where your location is and make sure and get out.
Well, good luck tonight, and good luck to Don. I'm sure he's still figuring out how to turn on his computer. So we'll start there. Good luck tonight, and
thanks.
I hope tonight goes well for you.
Thanks for having me in. You bet.
Take care.
Pete Hegseth will be joining us just after 8:30. We'll also be joined on the phone by Jeff Johnson coming up, and hopefully female-friendly Doritos.
Well, yeah, we got to save some time for that.
I know. I'm looking forward to that.
Lady Doritos.
Lady what?
This is